This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
My Eileen, her eyes are as blue as the skies that shine over lovely Greenough. Her hair purest gold.
Hello, and welcome to part two of our documentary on Harold O'Sullivan for Dundalk FM. In this part, we will be focusing more on his life before he became a historian he is now known as. In his life, he was a soldier, a civil servant, and a trade unionist. Before I begin, there are a few things I would like to say. Much of my information on Harold O'Sullivan's involvement with the Irish Local Government Officers Union comes from the book Servants to the Public by Martin Maguire. The book was very kindly given to me by Shea Cody when we went to visit him in Dublin. You'll be hearing from him soon. My point is, I am keenly aware that all my information on these events comes second hand, and I'm about to try and relate them to people who might very well have been there. If that is the case, I can only ask you to be patient with me as I summarise some of the most important events of your life and probably miss all the important details. I also have no desire to open old wounds, particularly relating to the pay differential dispute of the early 60s and the Women's Association. With that said, let us begin. One of the joys of making this documentary was the unexpected people I got to meet along the way. Through friends of friends, I was lucky enough to get to talk to Felix O'Callaghan. Felix was Harold's nephew, and he was willing to talk to us about him. He invited myself and Alan down to his house for what turned out to be a fascinating conversation.
Well, it's Harry you want to ask about Harold O'Sullivan. Now, Harold was married to my aunt, my mother's sister, and that whole family was raised on the other half of this site down at the bottom of the garden, and there was a huge number of ladies, and their father was Willie Kern, who was very much involved in theatrics and all that sort of thing around Dundalk. And there were fine looking women, and Harry got probably the most lively of the whole lot of them. He got Lily, the youngest. And they had 58 years of marriage. That was in the early 1950s. And my first recollection of Harry, and we called him Harry, by the way, not Harold, was his wedding down in that house down there where they had the wedding reception. And I was absolutely fascinated by all the fashion. And Harry was a different sort of a guy, because the rest of my family, and especially the males, the ladies married, were all fairly gregarious and outgoing and full of fun, and they all loved drinking and acting the maggot and all that sort of thing. Normal sort of people, singing and dancing and all that sort of thing at parties. Harry was always one of the reserved people, sitting in the background, saying very little, with the result that initially Harry seemed to be a bit of an outcast. He was very much a loner on his own and a very reserved man. So when they had their first child, Sean, it was discovered after about 9 months that Sean suffered from a disease, that he was had an inability to absorb certain proteins, and he was more or less disabled mentally and physically. The second child, Gary, was born about 2 years later. And he was actually identified as being suffering from the same disease. But the disease, and the doctor who did the test was colorblind and didn't realize that the child had this. So they were left with these two children. I never realized just how much it broke their heart, because at the time they had one of their eldest sisters. My mother's eldest sister was still resident down at the house as a single lady, and she looked after them. And my job as a child was to go down there and take those kids out on the road for a walk and everything like that. And the gentleman I had just buried this morning, he and I had a ferocious fisticuffs up the road, where he starts to call me names for pushing this pram with this handicapped child in it. I grew up loving that child and teaching him how to practically talk and play the piano. And then I went away into the army. And the day I went to join the army. I got the call from the papers to go into the military college, the cadet school. I went down and I saw Lily and Harry, and I knew Harry was not very enthusiastic about me joining the army. I never even knew that Harry had been in the army at this stage.
Harold O'Sullivan spent much of his life in Dundalk, and his work was animated by a fascination with the area. But he was born in Dublin. How did he first end up here? He was posted here during the Second World War.
He was educated at the Christian Brothers. He got a very hard upbringing. His father was a company sergeant in the army at the time, and Harry got a very tough upbringing. They moved to the Curragh. Harry joined the army as a private soldier, a trooper in the cavalry corps. He obviously had talent because they put him on an officer's course, commissioned him, I think, around 1944. And he was sent to Dundalk. And he was a member of what he called, very sarcastically, the Piddling Panzers. They were a cyclist squadron. And, of course, everybody derided the cyclist squadrons until the Vietnamese showed the Americans that cyclist squadrons were very, very effective. And the Germans had used them significantly during the war. But Harry, Sarah used to tell me stories about the war where they had to practice with wooden rifles and things like that, get all their basic training. But he was commissioned into the cavalry corps, which I was subsequently to join. So we had that in common as well.
Of course, Felix had to tell us what a cavalry corps means in a modern context.
A cavalry corps is an armoured corps that was set up when the Brits left us 14 Rolls-Royce armoured cars or whatever it was back in the 1920s. And probably one of the most effective units that there is anywhere in the Irish Army is a cavalry unit, because they're half infantry, half artillery, quarter infantry, quarter artillery, cavalry, wheeled, etc., 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 and then highly technical. So Harry really enjoyed that. But he was sent here to Dundalk, I think, around 1945, and he served here in Dundalk, and he retired from Dundalk.
I asked Felix what Harold thought of the town of Dundalk when he first arrived here.
Absolutely poverty-stricken, poor British Army town. Because do not ever forget that this was a British Army town for centuries, and that there is still more recognition of what the British Army are or are not, well, certainly what they are or what they think they are, around this town. So much so that when the guys in 1916 went off from here, and my granduncle Paddy Hughes was the leader of those guys, set off from Dundalk, the AOH Hall, and they got as far as somewhere up around RD or beyond RD, and then they had to come back because they were told the thing was practically over. As they came back down the town of Dundalk, they were spat upon, my father told me, from one end of the town to the other. So Dublin wasn't the only place that had wanted nothing to do with these people. But this was an old British Army garrison town, which is why I think I've looked around at certain people who would like to think that they are part of that establishment. I don't necessarily mean politically, but that from a social point of view, they'd like to be something that they're just not. Mm. And he had a great love for the town of Dundalk. And he said, you know, you people are far better than you make yourselves out to be. You know, that was one of the reasons he wrote so much about the history of Dundalk, was to try and lift our own opinion about how good a town we actually are and how far back we go.
Speaking to Felix was very different to any of the other people I'd interviewed. He knew Harold very personally, and he was able to provide a lot of context for some of the things I'd heard about him or read about him.
One of the things about army training that Harry and I discussed is it gives you that unique capability of understanding how to treat people. Because unlike other armies, we treat our soldiers very, very well. And it's only right, because they are part of us and we're only part of a volunteer outfit. So there's very little of the bullshit, if you like, of the British Army or the American Army, the way they like to portray themselves. We portray ourselves as being, you've got to do your job, you're highly trained, you're highly skilled. We have a responsibility to you, and our job is to lead you, not to dominate you. You know, now he was a labour man at heart, very much a labour man. He didn't think very much of some of the more recent Labour leaders. He used to call them pink salmon socialists, smoked salmon socialists. And some of them, he said, never worked in their lives. They were always just officials in various unions, etc. He had very little time for anybody who would wrap the green flag round them and proclaim that they were more Irish than the rest of us, ordinary beings. Excuse me. He also hadn't much time for the Blue Rinse Brigade of Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, because he always said they're out of touch with reality. And as far as the poor unionists were concerned in Northern Ireland, he just would dismiss them and say they don't know any better. It's the way they were brought up.
Harold O'Sullivan first tried to join the local government officers' union as an engineer's assistant in Kildare County Council. He was rejected at that time, as he was classified as a servant and not an officer. He tried again when he worked as a health inspector in Kildare. Again, the union rejected him as his post was temporary. Shea Cody was able to tell me a bit about this struggle.
It would have been a view that, I suppose, it would have gone back to permanent workers were appointed following full open public competitions. And there was a view that, let's say, you weren't appropriate to be in the union unless you'd come through that system. He was, as I said, a health inspector. That was a kind of a service that was beginning to grow. And at the early stage, they were only taking on temporary staff. And he took the view that it was the job of the union to represent all workers within the employment. And as I said, he had to climb a steep hill to get into the union, and would have taken the view thereafter that one of the jobs of the union was to look after temporary, part-time, casual workers, which is still a matter for the current day.
When he joined as a health inspector in Kildare and subsequently transferred back to Dundalk to chase Lily, I believe, my aunt, Harry was the absolute bane of industry and shopkeepers around the town. He was a ferocious inspector of health and safety standards. And there were many a businessman in Dundalk did not like Harry very much. But on the other hand, people in terrible housing conditions down the quay at the time and in various other places, Ryson's Lane and all the places that there were, there was quite a lot of poor, and I mean really poor people in this town. And I remember it as a child going to school and watching the poverty. And even on our own road here, there was a lot of poverty. But Harry was keenly aware of these people. And many's a person, even to this day, an older person will say that only for Harold O'Sullivan, they'd never have gotten a decent house. And they'd never have gotten this, that and the other thing. So he really looked after people, took his job very seriously, and then was obviously interested in the rights of the worker, etc., etc., and got involved in the local government union.
When he finally did join as an officer in Louth County Council, the Irish Local Government Officers Union seemed more like a professional association or an exclusive club than it did a proper trade union.
He got involved in that because the local government services union were paid little in comparison to normal civil servants. So Harry fought most of his life to get them put on that same level as every other union in the country, and especially the civil service.
At this time, the union's numbers were stagnant, its finances were heading into the red, and there was a great deal of frustration with the leadership, which consisted of a series of unelected executive committees that were thought to be out of touch with the needs of the members. Aside from very kindly loaning me the book, Shea Cody was able to tell me a little bit more about that time himself.
Okay, I'm Shea Cody. I'm the Senior General Secretary of FORSA, which is a union created earlier on in 2018 from Impact, which would be a successor organisation of the Local Government and Public Services Union that obviously had a long-standing relationship with Harold O'Sullivan. Harry was a health inspector by trade or profession. And ironically, when he qualified, he wanted to join the old Irish Local Government Officials Union. And because he didn't have a permanent job, they were reluctant to take him into membership. And he fought that up and down. And by the time they eventually took him into the union, they had made a formidable enemy. So he got very involved in the union and, in effect, over a period of time, undermined and overthrew the executive types that had kept him out at the start, and eventually became president of the union. Subsequently, then he became General Secretary of the Union, which is a full-time position. And once he became General Secretary of the Union, he found kind of a national stage to operate on. Mm-hmm. And within the Congress, he worked his way through the Congress. He was a member of the Congress Executive, would have been a significant negotiator in dealings with government, and was President of Congress around the time of the PAYE marches in the late 1970s and thereabouts. So he had been a very, very prominent active public figure of the time. I knew Harold O'Sullivan going back to before Impact was created in the early 1990s. Harold, or Harry as we would have known him, was the General Secretary of the Local Government and Public Services Union. I worked with the Professional and Technical Civil Servants Union, and we were beginning exploratory talks about the possibility of a merger. That was greatly assisted by the fact that Harry would have been held in very, very high regard by trade unionists in many unions, and we would have a significant overlap in interests, in the sense that he represented a lot of grades in local government that would have been pretty similar to the grades that we represented in the civil service. Harry was very involved in the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, in the Public Services Committee. He was a major player in all the negotiations and would have been seen as a very good friend of unions right across the spectrum.
In 1962, he was elected president with the support of the Dublin Corporation, who were the largest and most militant branch of the union. Harold's election represented a generational shift. He was the first president that had been recruited after the emergency, and the first to come from the lower pay grades as well.
I would have met Harold O'Sullivan in the very late 1970s at ICTU conferences, but actually I would have heard of Harold O'Sullivan before that, because relatives of mine had been involved in both the local government union and also in the John of Gods. So I would have known of Harold O'Sullivan before I ever met him. And I suppose that kind of tells you everything, that he had a reputation that preceded him. But when you went to those Congress meetings in the late 70s, early 80s, and you looked around the room, you knew where the kind of leaders were, and he was always, let's say, in that cabal.
The book Shea gave me suggests that Harold's election was part of a larger push to reorganise the ILGOU. At the time, the union wasn't exactly in a strong position, but what members it had were growing more militant and more dissatisfied with the leadership. By the time of the 1963 conference, the push for reorganisation seems to have largely succeeded. The union had brought in new members, the old Central Committee was abolished, and the union formally affiliated itself with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. It's worth mentioning at this point in history, that is, the early 60s, the Local Government Officers Union was unusual in not accepting a pay differential for its members based on their sex. In the civil service, in the private sector, almost everywhere else it was a given that men were paid more than women. This isn't to say that the issue wasn't divisive in the union. Perhaps there wouldn't have been calls for a sex differential exactly, but a bonus for married officers who had families to support would have been far more palatable. At this time, women were still required to leave public employment when they married, so this would have been a sex differential in effect. During pay negotiations in 1951, the Dublin Corporation had proposed exactly this, informally. The union delegates at the time refused to even discuss it, but the issue wouldn't go away. In 1962, the union's pay claim was, for the first time, put to an arbitrator. This was something the union had wanted for years, to spare it the constant, exhausting battles with the government. The arbitrator did indeed recommend a new pay scale with a higher top rate, but it was higher for the men. At this point, a number of women officers in the union began to organise, both against the arbitrator's finding and against the National Executive Committee accepting it. They didn't entirely trust the NEC. During the negotiations, the arbitrator wanted to propose what they called a marriage allowance. Harold forced them to admit that what they were proposing was effectively a sex differential. It seems he was betting that the government and the arbitrator wouldn't want to put their names to such a nakedly discriminatory practice. He lost that bet. Maguire, in his book, stopped short of speculating whether this represented a deliberate attempt on the part of the government to hammer a wedge into the union, but that is what it amounted to. At a special meeting of the Dublin Corporation on October 25th, a motion was put forward by Evelyn Owens challenging the committee's right to even accept the deal under the union's policy regarding equality of pay. The result was that the committee, instead of deciding one way or the other, called a referendum of the entire membership. The divided nature of the union can be seen in a quote from the memorandum on the decision. The officer board were of the view that the award should be accepted, but on the clear understanding that the union will seek the restoration of an undifferentiated scale at the earliest opportunity. The majority of the membership voted to accept the award, which didn't really solve anything. In November, the women of the Dublin branches called a meeting in the Engineers' Hall. Harold O'Sullivan chaired the meeting, though he wasn't even invited at first. Here the women decided to convene a national meeting in Athlone, and also affirmed that they would resign from the union if the pay differential was accepted. At the national meeting, the Association of Women Officers of the Local Authorities of Ireland was officially formed. In its brief existence, it would prove more effective at organising the women officers than the union had been. They challenged the committee's decision in court and also tried to bring political pressure to bear. The matter was raised in the Dáil by a number of TDs, including Noel Brown and Michael Higgins. Among other things, it was pointed out that Ireland's coming entry into the European common market would mean abandoning sex differentials in pay. The Women's Association, though they were now organised, didn't have many good options. They couldn't join another union. The one they were in had been the last to accept pay differentials. Their only choices were to stay with the ILGOU or to try and form their own union. Evelyn Owens and Harold O'Sullivan met in the Anchor Hotel in Parnell Square, where he assured her that the Women's Association would have his full support in trying to overturn the pay differential. At a subsequent meeting, they decided to cooperate in bringing a case to the arbitrator and trying to meet with the Minister of Local Government. The Minister, however, was less than cooperative. He didn't want the issue of equal pay entering into the political arena. In the end, a confrontation was averted by the Donegal County Council, who proposed paying all their women officers the men's rate. The minister was happy to accept this arrangement since it let everyone off the hook. The fudge persisted until 1974 and the employment and quality legislation that was passed in that year. This seems to have been Harold's first real challenge as a union leader, and I'm frustrated to only learn about it after finishing the interviews. Maguire credited as one of the first stirrings of the feminist movement in post-revolutionary Ireland. Certainly it told the broader trade union movement that women's equality had to be taken seriously. As for how much credit Harold deserves for his role in all this, well, I think it's fair to say that he recognised the grievances of the women's officers were completely legitimate, and he managed to hold together a not terribly united or strong union at a dangerous moment, allowing it to survive and grow in the long term. Harold was there for that long term as well. Shea had a lot to say about his long term influence on the unions.
I'd say maybe the first important thing was he learned how to listen. And very often people think a good negotiator is somebody who can talk. Harold was well able to articulate his view and force a point, but he had the understanding that you were rarely going to change somebody else's point of view unless you understood their point of view in the first instance. And he had a skill around that a lot of people should learn in order to make progress in life. No, he had a great heart that way, and people within the trade union movement would have spoken about the time and effort Harry put into dealing with both national stuff but also individual cases where he felt the wrong was being done. I suppose that's why he was held in such high regard in the trade union movement, even by people who wouldn't necessarily have shared his perspective in life.
What sort of landscape were we looking at for the union that Harold O'Sullivan would have been operating in?
Well, the landscape was very much that there was no, I suppose, structured dialogue between unions and government. There was no place to talk about anything beyond the narrow terms and conditions of workers within their employment. And also, you have to look at, it was the era, certainly in the 80s, of Thatcher. And it was possible for Irish trade unions to look across the water and see that standing outside and shouting slogans and marching and protesting, as opposed to trying to negotiate with government, wasn't very successful. The miners had lost a major dispute in the UK. Thatcher was in the ascendancy. And there was a strong view in the Irish trade union movement that we should avoid those mistakes. And I suppose that's the foundations around where Harry was coming from, his experience in the 60s and 70s of, you know, massive inflation, a lot of emigration, a lot of unemployment, and unions only dealing with a very narrow bargaining agenda. That should be challenged. And I would have to say he was very successful in sowing those seeds that I suppose were coming to fruition around the time he retired and then carried on for decades afterwards. Because the idea of sitting across the table from government in its capacity as government and talking about, I suppose, the social spectrum of issues was the product of people like Harry O'Sullivan and indeed Phil Flynn, another county man. And the move by the Irish Congress of Trade Union in the mid-80s to move into the area of social partnership was driven by the two of them. The motion that adopted that approach to life was a motion from the local government union. It was supported then nationally by, you know, the other big unions, the Workers' Union of Ireland, the Transport Union. And it coincided with a kind of a political change in the sense that Fianna Fáil came to power in the mid-80s, and they had been searching for that as well. And in fact, even in the more recent documentaries around Charlie Haughey, it was noted that Charlie Haughey was greatly influenced by that worldview in the German trade unions and the German unions meeting with the German government. Helmut Schmidt had told Charlie Haughey that one of the most important meetings he had in his yearly calendar was his meeting about the, I suppose, perspectives for the year with the German trade union movement. And I suppose that provided fertile territory for Harry and the ideas he was pushing to get that accepted in Ireland. He was, I suppose, a social democrat in the modern European sense. Within the trade union movement, he never was part of kind of, let's say, ultra-leftism. He would have seen that the job of the union was to negotiate with whatever government was there. He would have been a champion of national bargaining. He would have been a champion of, I suppose, what eventually became known as social partnership. He believed that unions could only go so far in negotiating on paying conditions with their immediate employer, but things like, you know, housing costs, childcare costs, social services had as much an effect on people's living standards as the amount of wages that they had. So Harry would have been of the view that if we're talking to government, we should be talking to government about a full spectrum of social issues affecting workers. And he would have been a champion of that within the trade union world. Obviously, as we went from the 70s into the 80s, that actually became the common worldview of the trade union movement.
I mean, if he was in that sort of position again today, what do you think?
Well, he was always a blunt speaker, so he would be certainly, in my view, challenging this view that was portrayed in the media that social partnership was a bad thing. He would be taking the view that the job of the trade unions is to look after the entire spectrum of issues facing their members, and we should be down in government buildings talking to government about it, talking to the national employers about it, talking to the other social actors like the farming organisations, that if you are restricting yourself to a narrow agenda with a single employer, you are never going to deal with the full spectrum of issues. And I think in truth, even though social partnership obviously crumbled in the crisis around 2009 or thereabouts, the, let's say, early bulbs showing at this stage are showing that both the employers' bodies and government are seeing a small open economy like Ireland needs a place like that where we can talk about the big national problem.
So you took this very holistic, systemic view of, you know, society and the role of the trade unions in society.
Absolutely. And he had obviously a background in public service, his family situation. He had two children that relied on the state enormously in Drumcar, and he would have been, a champion of those services, a champion of, you know, acknowledging the role played by staff in that sort of situation. Obviously, it was not possible to have his children at home, and obviously that was a personal tragedy for him, but it would have reinforced his role that in the lives of a worker, even like himself, that you couldn't just count out the terms and conditions you could negotiate with your employer. It had to be a much bigger worldview, and that was Harry's perspective on life within the trade union movement.
Again, I find there's really only time to give you an overview of Harold's life. I haven't even been able to touch on the PAYE protests in the 80s, or the time he was called in to try and negotiate an end to the siege of Monasternevin. Each of these subjects would be more than enough for a documentary on their own. And we are a community radio station, so it's entirely possible they'll each get one someday. In the meantime, all I can say is, I hope I was able to do some justice to Harold O'Sullivan. We won't see his like again. This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, with the television licence fee.